I got a dog.
Yeah, so this dog is Aldo?
I think he's going to be Aldo.
I love Aldo.
He's a rescue.
He's like... only three, they say. I don't know.
So cute though, right?
He's from the Animal Control Center, which, you know, is like the animal police. Like they pick up. So who knows?
Who knows?
But he walked right up to me, plopped his butt down and tucked his head under my leg. And so the wand chose the wizard. Yeah, it's done.
Okay. Wonderful. The wand chose the wizard. Oh, so, I love it.
Aldo it is.
That's a cute name.
And my brother-in-law is a pharmacist, and he came with me to, like, check it out. So I was like, I really wanted to be a diuretic, you know? And he's like, what about ethocrinic acid? What's the trade name of ethocrinic acid? I'm like, absolutely not.
Oh, my God.
It is ethocrinic.
Eddie.
I'm campaigning for Emil for a Milleride. I'm just saying.
But Emil, you can't yell at Emil. I like, my childhood dog's name was Edmund, and we called him Eddie. So.
Eddie's a good name.
Aldo's a great name.
It is.
Aldo really is a good
name. Yeah. Anyway.
Renal physiology, a complex yet logical and internally consistent system that maintains our precious bodily fluids. You are listening to an accounting of our ongoing mission to explore and develop a functional mental model of the workings of the kidney and its associated functions. To understand completely how the kidney accomplishes its primary mission of establishing and maintaining homeostasis, this is Channel Your Enthusiasm, the Burton Rose Cocktail Club and Variety Hours. My name is Joel Toff, and I'll be your host tonight. Tonight, we are discussing metabolic alkalosis, Chapter 18. We are so excited for Chapter 18. I can't tell you. And it is a great, great chapter. And I think, and I really do think that Burton Rose 1999 was ahead of the curve here. I think everybody else in nephrology was still stuck on contraction alkalosis, and he gives it lip service, but he is zeroing in on chloride deficiency all through the chapter. It is great. Tonight, we got an excellent crew. Josh?
Hey there, Josh Waitsman. I'm a nephrologist and scientist at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston.
JC?
Juan Carlos Velez, nephrologist at Ochsner in New Orleans.
Melanie?
Melanie Honig, nephrologist at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center.
Roger.
Roger Rodby, nephrologist at Chicago, Rush University Medical Center.
Anna.
I'm Anna Gaddy. I'm a nephrologist at the Medical College of Wisconsin.
Amy.
And I'm Amy Yao. I am also a nephrologist at The Ohio State University in Columbus, Ohio.
Excellent.
Why are we even saying that? I think it's like it's addictive. Like you say it, so I say it. Like, yeah, we're all
nephrologists. Well, we're a little slap happy tonight because we just talked to a non-nephrologist. So we just had like the cool kid over for dinner and we're all like, I'm a nephrologist. Yeah, I think that's why.
We had just finished recording with the Glockenfleckens. Link in the show notes.
Yeah, none of us had a crisis of faith in the last month and converted to cardiology or anything like that.
Joel, would we get kicked off the podcast?
No, you guys are locked in until
locked
you guys
in?
Quit. Until we finish.
Who could get to replace us?
That's true. At this stage.
Actually, that would be easy. There's so many people who would love to be in it.
I think that's the case.
That says more about Melanie's social circle.
You guys are real celebrities and a lot of people trade positions with you. But again, like I've always said, I asked you to do this for 2 years and this has taken way longer than I ever expected. If you guys ever want to bow out, you are welcome to bow out.
You shut your mouth.
Okay. We'll stop there. We'll move along.
I already
okay.
have two kids from this, Joel, so maybe it, like, we'll have
this podcast has gotten Amy pregnant twice.
It's a fertility ritual. That's right.
When this was recorded, I had just had my second child, who is now turning 3 this summer. But this endeavor has taken so long that I've actually had 3 kits during the recording and production. And now my third child is turning 1 later this month. I'm so thankful to become a mom and share this experience with my friends on the podcast. So, listen at your own risk. The next thing you know, you'll be picking out baby names while learning about the kidney.
Okay, metabolic alkalosis. Elevation of arterial pH, an increase in plasma bicarb, and compensatory hypoventilation. He says that an elevated bicarb could also be compensation for respiratory acidosis. So make sure you take a look at the pH to differentiate these two. But he does point out that if the bicarb is over 40, this is not just going to be compensation for respiratory acidosis. Your bicarb goes over 40, you definitely have metabolic alkalosis. And then he uses the kind of the classic, we're going to divide metabolic alkalosis into two phases. You're going to have a certain number of things that can generate metabolic alkalosis. But for the only way that it can be clinically meaningful is if it's maintained. So you have a generation and then a maintenance, and you have to satisfy both of them to have metabolic alkalosis. And then I have a comment here. I said, great table, table one. Josh, you want to tell us what we got in table one?
Yeah, so it divides up the causes of metabolic alkalosis to loss of protons, which is going to lead to, basically getting rid of protons is the same as putting more bicarb in. So including GI gastric content losses from nasogastric tube, renal losses, including diuretics, hyperaldosterone states, too much dog, and then a couple of other kind of more minor causes, and then some cell shift causes, moving hydrogen ions into cells, potassium out of cells, and then just retaining bicarbonate from stuff like milk alkali syndrome, massive blood transfusion, and then contraction, or we'll talk about chloride depletion alkalosis. So this is the third big category there. I think this is a really nice list. It seems like it's aged pretty well. The only thing I could find that I was curious about, are there other antibiotics that do the carbenicillin penicillin thing? And there are a couple, like imipenem, meropenem can do it. But honestly, I've never seen it from those. So it seems like this is as good of a list as we're going to get.
Anybody else? Anybody think it's missing something? I thought it was pretty comprehensive.
I didn't like the redundancies. I didn't know why they had to have, and what we're going to get deep into the term contraction, I'm sure.
Yep.
But I don't know why he couldn't have, you know, we've got lupinthiazides on the renal loss list. So why do we need them again?
I mean, you could lose blood from hemorrhage or something too, right?
It indicates that it's two separate etiologies, which it isn't, right? I mean,
I think it is. We'll argue later.
Well, I think it becomes germane when we talk about later, and I'm sure we'll get into this, but when we talk about like chloride repletion, like giving saline or giving lysine chloride to abrogate contraction alkalosis. So it's kind of like, well, is there a contraction alkalosis that can only be ameliorated by not contracting the person? And then there's also the chloride depletion, or is it really truly the same thing? So it's really truly the same thing that we shouldn't list it under two. You know what I mean? Because it becomes germane when we talk about how to fix it. So I'm sure we'll get into that, but yeah. And let's not now.
If we're going to get picky, I don't like the term retention of bicarbonate, because retention of bicarbonate is really the maintenance phase of metabolic alkalosis. I prefer it says retention of administered bicarbonate, because that's really what they're describing in those three things there. So
yeah, I think that's a good point. And there's already, you know, there is a hint. We're biting at the bit to talk about contraction, which I'm not going to say yet. But he does say above the table, when he's listing the causes, he says you could develop a metabolic alkalosis, and he lists the reasons, and by certain forms of contraction, hint, hint. So I just point that out there, because a lot of times people, as we all know, not everybody who's volume depleted has an alkalosis. So it must be different.
Yeah, Melanie, I don't think there's any reason to delay. There's no reason to delay. We got contraction alkalosis on page 553, the very next page. You're jumping at the bit. Go.
Well, no, I mean, I think that the really big problem, and I know others want to talk about this, so.
But let's open it up. So what's the idea behind contraction alkalosis?
So historically, people said, a metabolic alkalosis occurs. This was the way people explained it to me, was you are contracted around a fixed amount of bicarbonate. And so then you have more bicarbonate concentration-wise than you did. But that just doesn't really work. There has to be a chloride loss. And so that's why I'm poking at that.
Well, so first of all, he says, you know, he's very specific. He said the loss of fluid has to be bicarb poor, right? So he says that bleeding won't cause this, right? Because when you bleed, you lose bicarb at the same rate that you're losing sodium and chloride and all the other volume. And so that's not going to cause a contraction alkalosis. And he really focuses in on diuretic loss, right? Am I correct?
Well, thiazides and loops.
Thiazides and loops specifically.
Mm-hmm. And it has,
Melanie, how can, if you lose a fluid that is low in bicarb, how can your bicarb concentration not go up?
It does go up.
That's contraction.
Yeah, but it's not, so it's not just loss of, say, water. Like, for example, patients with diabetes insipidus who lose water, they don't get a metabolic alkalosis.
Why not?
They have to.
But they don't, because they don't lose chloride. They have the same, proportionally, the same amount of chloride and bicarbonate. So it has to be a chloride loss. And so for thiazides and loops, you have sodium and chloride lost, and that distal delivery of sodium and chloride, and then we have the whole interplay. So you deliver sodium and chloride to the distal nephron, and then sodium, some can be reabsorbed in the principal cells, the lumen's negative, that favors loss of K and hydrogen.
Yes.
And when you excrete that hydrogen, you're making a new bicarbonate. There's your bicarb. So you're losing a chloride and gaining a bicarb.
Well, and the other important aspect of that is if when you reabsorb that sodium, that chloride is a reabsorbable anion. If it's sodium and chloride that gets delivered to the distal nephron, the reabsorption of sodium through the ENaC channel increases that negative charge there, and chloride will also be reabsorbed. I think it's a paracellular reabsorption, or there's also an exchange over it. We'll talk about that in a bit. But that chloride reabsorption disrupts that negative charge and actually competes with both potassium secretion and hydrogen secretion. And so the lack of chloride is super critical for enhancing that hydrogen secretion, i.e. increased bicarbonate synthesis.
Yeah, the term contraction, the misconception that I have encountered is, you know, essentially what Melanie said. But I think the confusion sometimes is putting the word contraction equals volume contraction. And when you think about volume contraction and you have a patient that is volume depleted, which could be from diarrhea or from other cause, and the bicarb is up, then the immediate thought is, oh, this is contraction alkalosis. And it's not that. It's not all phenomena that lead to volume contraction lead to metabolic alkalosis for the reasons that Melanie
mentioned. Hey, JC, I don't love that example because diarrhea causes a metabolic acidosis. Do you want to redo that with vomiting or diuretics?
No, but I'm talking about an example of a case that is volume depleted.
Yeah.
And yet the final consequence is the opposite of metabolic alkalosis, right?
Right. Because That's right.
So that's what I was trying to say. You know, Melanie used the example of diabetes insipidus, where the loss is water. You may not know.
And there's no acid-base disorder in DI?
No acid-base disturbance, correct. No. Not unless something else is going on. But from the pure loss of water, it shouldn't be an acid-base.
Even though they do get contracted, they will get their sodium will be driven up. And that sodium going up is clearly contraction, right? Fixed amount of sodium and less water, right? Yeah. So that's an example of contraction hypernatremia. Where's contraction hypernatremia in this book?
It's funny because when I first learned about contraction alkalosis, I never thought how he talks about it contracting around a constant quality of extracellular bicarb. I literally always thought of it as the patient's volume down, and so they're reabsorbing sodium bicarb in the proximal tubule, and so they're contracted alkalosis. That's how I've always thought about it.
But that's not the classic description, right?
But that's maintenance. That's not generation. You have to first generate it. So you have to generate it by a loss of chloride. Here, I'm talking about loops and thiazides. But it could be vomiting, as you just said. And you have to have a loss of chloride if we're doing losses. And then maintenance, which I'll hold off on for a second, because Roger's still looking unhappy. He doesn't like, he's not happy yet. We got to get you happy, man. Go for it.
Does anybody want to go through figure 18.1, which is his visual representation of this contraction alkalosis?
That's exactly what contraction is describing. You've got a fixed amount of bicarb, a 528 milliequivalents of total bicarb in 22 liters. And you lower that to 17 liters. And now the bicarb has to go up. I mean, I don't understand this chloride thing. I mean, I understand chloride in the maintenance phase. I understand that totally. But you can't tell me that if you got this beaker of bicarb in a certain solution and you remove a certain amount of that with less chloride that's what's in there, or less bicarb than what is in there, which is what we're talking about, losing a fluid that's lower bicarb than your body, the bicarb concentration has to go up. There's nothing, that's nothing to do with the kidney. That's contraction.
Wait, but the fluid that you lost is sodium chloride. And the sodium and chloride we're losing, theoretically, is 1-to-1, maybe, right? And, right, because if you're blocking a loop or a thiazide channel, you're losing 1-to-1 sodium and chloride. But we don't have the same amount of sodium and chloride in our blood, right? Because we have, I'm hearing something, right? Because we have about roughly 140 of sodium and roughly 108 or 110 of chloride. So proportionally, we're losing more chloride. And I don't like strong ion, but we're losing more chloride than sodium. And so if you're losing sodium and chloride, then yes, you're contracting around the amount of bicarb. But when you lost that chloride, you lost hydrogen too, right?
Yeah, I think it's the loss of chloride out of proportion to the rest. It's like if you are deprived from any fluid intake, you're a nursing home patient, you're left on the floor for 3 days, come to the hospital with a sodium of 165. They're not alkalotic because they had deficit of chloride and they have deficit of bicarb. They have everything with everything. It's only when you vomit that you lose more chloride and bicarb, or you have loop diuretics that you lose more chloride and bicarb. That leads to the chloride depletion part. So I'm all here kind of following what Melanie said. And in fact, I mean, this paragraph of the perpetuation of metabolic alkalosis, I mean, it's probably one of the most impactful paragraphs that I recall earlier.
Which paragraph is this?
It says maintenance of metabolic alkalosis on page 553 that says the perpetuation of metabolic alkalosis requires an impermanent renal bicarbonate excretion.
That's all about maintenance. We're still talking about...
Right. Okay, Roger, I got this. Roger, do you agree when you take a thiazide and you lose sodium and chloride, right? Don't you also lose K?
Yes.
Okay, how does that happen? Roger?
You get increased distal delivery of sodium in the presence of hyperaldosteronism. That sodium is reabsorbed through the ENaC channel.
Even before, you're not hyperaldo right away, right?
No, but it necessarily doesn't matter. You're going to get the reabsorption. You're going to get the distal delivery of sodium. Sodium's going to reabsorb through the ENaC channel, increases the negative charge in the tubule, increases potassium secretion.
Okay. So remember, I mean, we've been very methodical about going through this book in order. And we spent some time thinking about the cobblestoning of the collecting duct and how those cells work together, how we have the intercalated cells and the principal cells together. So one thing that's very cool is when you lose some K from loops or thiazides, you lose hydrogen too. Those are sort of balanced.
Yeah.
And so we definitely lose hydrogen with ammonia, right? As ammonium chloride, when you give loops and thiazides, right? Isn't that even a test that we do to see if the function of the distal nephron is right? We give somebody a loop diuretic to see if they put out hydrogen, right? So don't we know that in essence, when we give loops and thiazides, we are losing hydrogen and K, those are sort of balanced. And we are therefore, when we put out that hydrogen, it doesn't come from nowhere. It comes from making hydrogen that goes in the lumen and bicarbonate that goes in the blood. That's your generation.
That's all fine. But I mean, you're speaking physiologically, which is maybe where my problem is. I'm not even speaking about anything to do with physiology. I'm saying, if you've got this beaker here and all these concentrations, I can pull out a certain amount of fluid that has less bicarb and more chloride. The bicarb has to go up. That's the whole concept of contraction.
I agree with you, but you lost chloride, right? You lost chloride. I'm with you on that.
That's not hard. But what you're saying is that in practice, how do you get there?
But go back to the counter example that's so compelling is like, why don't you get an electrolyte disorder with DI?
That's going to keep me up all night. I'm really...
That's going to bake your noodle.
I'm really, really, really... Because let me tell you something. I had already decided that contraction alkalosis was the wrong term. That because what we should do is that contraction alkalosis to the extent that I was describing it, not physiologically, but, you know, that's the direct opposite of dilution acidosis, where you just add a fluid and you have less mm-hmm. bicarbonate. So we should have dilution acidosis. And I said, we should call it concentration alkalosis instead of contraction alkalosis and get rid of this whole confusion of contraction, which is the maintenance, which is related to the partially to the maintenance phase of metabolic alkalosis.
Yeah, now, but dilution. Go ahead.
No, but I'm saying, but now if you're saying that, I mean, you know, I was trying to give you an example, like if you just take a beaker and dilute, you know, let's say you take a beaker of you and you evaporate water, which is really DI, the bicarb will go up, but why does it not go up in DI?
Okay, but now hold on a second, Roger. Dilutional acidosis, that doesn't happen with hyponatremia. That happens when you give a lot of chloride-containing fluid.
Correct.
Okay, so there's more chloride that you're giving, and this is strange for me because I have historically hated chloride, but I'm now on team chloride here. So hyponatremia doesn't cause a metabolic acidosis. We all agree, right?
We agree.
But a dilutional acidosis is from IV fluids with a lot of chloride.
No, it's with IV fluids without bicarb. For which
anion is chloride.
Okay, I'm calling it. We're done with this. We're on page two.
Really?
Okay?
We're done?
With contraction alkalosis.
Oh, okay. All right.
We got to move on. Because here's the issue. Because the least interesting part about metabolic alkalosis is generation. Right? Because
okay.
Generation is a very transient thing. And what really is important is how do you maintain it? Right? Because we have already talked about all the work that the kidney does to reabsorb bicarb in the proximal tubule. Literally thousands of milliequivalents of bicarb are reabsorbed in the proximal tubule. And now the only thing that the kidney needs to do to correct metabolic alkalosis is not work so damn hard. Take a break, kidney. Come on, proximal tubule. Just ease up and let some of that bicarb fly by and you'll be able to correct this metabolic alkalosis like that.
I'm so happy you mentioned that because
Mel is like so
we didn't get to... sorry.
I know. Melody is like, boom, let's go.
No, I really want to get this in. I'm afraid you're going to tell me to go to sleep already. Okay. So you just mentioned an important story that normally, as soon as the bicarbonate gets over our normal threshold, you'll just dump bicarbonate, it will appear in the urine. And that was in chapter 11. And by the way, the reference is wrong there. But I pulled that paper, okay? And this is a paper by Robert Pitts from 1949, okay? You can't make this stuff up. First of all, there's three authors. All men, sorry. And then it says, thank you for the administrative help of Phyllis Minor. Fast forward to the actual paper. Three men, and this is what they do. They induce metabolic alkalosis, okay? And then they see what happens to their urine, all right? And three men, two of them self-cathed, and one of them demonstrated complete emptying of his bladder. So they allowed him to urinate into a funnel. And then all of the urine was collected under oil because you can't actually collect bicarbonate in the urine. Let me get you the actual paper. Here we go. I was talking about this with Stu Lecker today, and he lent me this book by Pitts. And so what did they do?
A note from the editor. Melanie took the next minute and 35 seconds trying to find out what they did.
I'm trying to get past the mental image of a guy putting his, I forgot the funnel for a second. It was really graphic.
Who among us have not peed under oil?
I have never done that.
Who of us has not self-cathed ourselves?
So in some experiments, they took 5 to 20 grams of ammonium chloride. And then in all of the experiments, they gave themselves an infusion of sodium bicarbonate. And then
That's what they did. And then they measured, and this is the figure that we've talked about before, which shows a sort of a, like kind of like a one-to-one, the bicarbonate in the filtrate compared to the plasma bicarbonate, such that all filtered up to about 24. And then once you get to 24, then bicarbonate above that, bicarbonate normally appears in the urine unless there's a stimulus to reabsorb more bicarbonate, aka maintenance of an alkalosis. So that's what I wanted to say.
PCO2 or high PCO2.
Yes. But we're going to do respiratory disorders for another night.
Okay.
Joel, you look unhappy.
So what? No, I'm just like, I just want to say, you know, the maintenance of metabolic alkalosis is the mirror image of a proximal RTA, right? In proximal RTA, we had a proximal tubule that was unable to reabsorb all the filtered bicarbonate. And now we have a proximal tubule that is inappropriately reabsorbing all of the filtered bicarbonate. Fair?
Yeah, there you go. And just, we always talk about the percentage of sodium that's reabsorbed proximally, but that percentage changes. So angiotensin II can rev up the sodium hydrogen exchanger and HE3, and then you can reabsorb way more sodium. And then, of course, because they're linked, bicarbonate proximally. And that is one of the key factors in maintenance.
Okay. And then he says the kidney responds to metabolic alkalosis by excreting excess bicarb in the urine, and that normal subjects given 1,000 mil equivalents of sodium bicarbonate per day for 2 weeks excretes virtually all the excess bicarbonate and develop only minor increases in plasma bicarb. Please, Melanie, tell me you pulled that reference.
No, I did. I could have pulled everything. You had to stop.
That's just bananas to me. That's so much bicarb.
But then there'd be nothing under her pillow.
I mean, you know, I just worked so hard for my patients to get like, you know, 650 or 1300 three times a day. Right. And that's like 32 mil equivalents of bicarb. And they're doing thousands, right? They're doing 1,000 mil equivalents. That's 48 mil equivalents of bicarb. I did my math wrong, but that's a massive amount. It's 20 times what we use physiologically to treat metabolic acidosis. It's a massive dose. And it's crazy that it doesn't, it barely moves the needle.
If I had five sentences of this chapter, that's one of the most important sentences. You can give somebody, if everything's normal, you can give them more bicarb than you could possibly take or tolerate, and your bicarb won't go up.
Yes.
That tells you how that really stresses the importance of maintenance. Because otherwise, it's ridiculous. There's no metabolic alkalosis.
There's this footnote at the bottom of 554, which I loved. He says, in this regard, metabolic alkalosis is similar to other excess disorders, such as hyponatremia, too much water, hyperkalemia, too much K, and edema, too much sodium. In each of these conditions, renal excretory capacity for the retained solute or water is normally so high that a defect in renal excretion must be present for the disorder to persist. Right? That's just perfect. It's exactly what Roger was saying. Metabolic alkalosis, that's the case for bicarb. Hyponatremia, that's the case for water. Edema, that's the case for sodium. And hyperkalemia, that's the case for potassium.
Yeah, that absolutely 100% agreed. How strong is that paragraph? I mean, in terms of the clinical relevance and, you know, how often we are discussing a case and the patient has an electrolyte disorder, let's say potassium is up, and the first reaction is, well, the patient was just eating bananas and looking for the for the exogenous source. But it happens all the time, Joel. You know that. It happens.
Yeah. No, I know. I don't. I laugh because it's exactly what happens.
It happened. Or in this case, you know, the patient just took, you know, baking soda. No, it has to be extreme. In the case of psychogenic polydipsia, it has to be, you know, 16, 18 liters of water before you become hyponatremic, right? So it's got to be completely out of whack to exceed the renal excretory capacity of all those things, sodium, potassium, water. And,
you know, it's the paragraphs like that that tell you just how special Bud Rose is.
100%.
It's an insight. It's like Homer Smith. It's just another level of getting it.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed. Okay, then I have a table 18.2. Anna, what do we got in table 18.2? What are we looking at there?
So like you were just saying, there has to be some other thing going on. It can't just be normal renal function. So this is the causes of impaired bicarb excretion that allow maintenance of metabolic alkalosis. So he has it broken down into two categories, either decreased GFR or increased tubular reabsorption. Decreased GFR is either decreased effective circulating volume or renal failure. And then increased tubular resorption is either effective circulating volume depletion, so decreased circulating volume, chloride depletion, presumably independent of effective circulating volume depletion, and then hypokalemia or hyperaldosteronism.
And the remarkable thing is that's it, right? It's six items, and one of them is repeated twice. Right.
Yeah.
And you're going to find that in all metabolic alkalosis. It's one of those five items. And usually, and oftentimes a combination, because you'll see the hypokalemia and the volume, either the hyperaldo or the volume depletion and walking together. But it's a pretty limited scope, but it's great. He kind of goes through the mechanism. So the decrease in GFR, he says that one of the things that's important about that is just going to be decreasing the filtered load. So it says that a decrease in GFR, one of the important things is that it'll decrease the filtered load. And then that the low GFR, as in chronic renal insufficiency, does not predispose to metabolic alkalosis, which kind of, that seems weird. It seems like he's contradicting himself.
Well, no, he's just saying that low GFR in and of itself doesn't predispose you, which we know that predisposes you to acidosis because we can't normally excrete our dietary acid load if you have renal failure. So that in of itself doesn't predispose you, but if you had those grams and grams of bicarbonate and you had renal failure, you would not be able to excrete it.
Gotcha. I love that he calls it chronic renal insufficiency. I said, Dr. Rose, your 90s are showing.
I miss that, honestly. I can't stand
CKD.
Don't
even get me started.
All right, never mind.
We will not get through tonight. We will never... Don't even get me started.
I can't stand CKD.
Roger, what's your position?
Oh, Melody's right. We changed everything. The nomenclature was fine.
Nephrology has gotten so exciting these days, it's hard to remember how bored we all were before the era of SGLT2 inhibitors. This led to some serious thumb twiddling. In 2020, Kidney International published the proceedings from a KDIGO nomenclature consensus conference with the stated goal of standardizing and refining kidney-related nomenclature. Based on thematic analysis from focus groups of 50 adults with CKD and 13 caregivers, KDIGO determined that the terms nephro and renal were apt to be misunderstood by patients and therefore recommended uniformity by, quote, using the term kidney rather than renal to describe kidney function and kidney disease, end quote. English language journals largely started to incorporate this recommendation into their publishing guidelines, and that's basically where we are today. Soon after, a retaliatory piece called Nomenclature in Nephrology, Preserving Renal and Nephro in the Glossary of Kidney Health and Disease was published in the Journal of Nephrology. This paper quoted Shakespeare and argued that cardiologists were not made to call heart attacks heart vessel events. A table of other medical specialties not made to follow glossaries was listed. Their core argument seemed to be that if clarity were not going to be sought everywhere, it should not be sought anywhere. There was also, of course, the grammatical root argument in that kidney and renal are two different types of word, as well as the argument that using renal when speaking to crowds with predominantly languages rooted in Latin was in fact easier to understand. A few months later, Kidney News published a piece on this topic, which quoted Andrew Levy, MD, the lead author of the consensus statement, as clarifying that KDIGO consensus conference did not recommend that kidneys should be used instead of renal or nephro in as many uses as possible. The recommendation applies for general terms related to kidney function and disease, not to specific anatomic structures, physiologic processes, or names of diseases. It's hard to say where this debate really started or where it began. ASN changed its annual meeting name from Renal Week to Kidney Week back in 2011, and it's incredibly hard to find much on the internet about why that decision was made. Authors from both of those papers have now successfully transplanted pig kidneys into humans, created a spatial cell atlas of kidney cell types, and established new clinical trial endpoints that have changed the way we treat patients, to name a few. Thankfully, it is 2025, and we have amazing new evidence-based interventions to be prescribing, and so this debate is just going to have to take a backseat.
CKD is terrible.
Why? What's terrible about it?
Oh, because now people are given a disease. They don't have a disease. They just have reduced kidney function. It's terrible. I actually just recently discovered the kidney failure risk equation website, and I am obsessed with it. I love it because you can plug in people's numbers and then show them it. Because I've told them, oh, you don't have proteinuria, you're going to be fine. And now, like, the website tells them, you do not have kidney failure. You do not have a disease. And then they believe me.
Yeah. I have someone who has your 5-year risk of developing kidney failure is 0%.
Wow. Right.
It's my, like, you're good. You don't need me.
Sorry. But back to you.
Kidney failure risk equation, kidneyfailurerisk.com, I believe that is the website.
Yeah.
Is awesome.
It
is a really, really good tool in the clinic for exact, and it works on both sides because I have patients that are refusing to get access, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And you can like plug it in. You're like, well, we're looking at a real possibility of dialysis in the next 2 years. We're looking at, 30, 40%. It's time to like make sure you've got your umbrella, right?
That's really, really useful. I got to start using it.
I haven't used it that way. That's a good idea.
I tell people all the time, you're going to be fine, Joel's side of it, it's really hard. I think that's a really objective way to help them get their access placed. I'm going to use it.
And then most filtered bicarbonate is reabsorbing the proximal tubule 90%, and the last 10% in the thick ascending limb of the loop of Henle. And so what contributes to the over-reabsorption of bicarbonate? So, right, so this is how it physiologically happens. So where are we getting this? And so he points out that first of all, when you have effective circulating volume depletion, that reabsorption of bicarbonate is occurring with, you have the sodium-hydrogen exchanger. And so it absolutely makes sense that you would be reabsorbing sodium, that you would be prioritizing the reabsorption of sodium. And that's one of the things that's going to force you to over-reabsorb bicarbonate relative to what you think the pH should be. Oh, and that when you have bicarbonate excretion in the urine, that necessitates the loss of sodium in the urine. So that by definition, correcting metabolic alkalosis is going to cause a sodium diuresis, which is dangerous if you're already volume depleted. And then he has what I wrote down as a confusing example that a low sodium diet results in a 4 mil equivalent per liter GFR. So for every liter of GFR, you'll increase your ability to reabsorb bicarbonate by 4 points. But that same increase, that same increment into the amount that the proximal tubule can reabsorb bicarbonate, if the patient has marked reductions in tissue perfusion, goes up to 35 mil equivalent per liter.
Yeah, Joel, I didn't understand that. You want to
Where are you?
554 middle.
So I think the idea here is he's giving you 2 degrees of volume depletion. So the first degree of volume depletion is just you're on a low sodium diet. And that low sodium diet is going to enhance your reabsorption of sodium in the proximal tubule. And the way he's measuring that reabsorption of bicarbonate in the proximal tubule is he says, for every liter of GFR you have, you're going to get an additional 4 mil equivalents of bicarbonate reabsorbed. And then the second example is not somebody just on a low sodium diet, but somebody who's gone through, say, cholera and has pretty profound volume deficiency and real sodium deficiency, not just a low sodium diet. And now they don't just have a bump in their reabsorption of bicarb by 4, they have a bump by 35 mil equivalents per liter. So just this kind of massive untapped potential to reabsorb essentially sodium in the proximal tubule under duress. And then the thing to remember is that reabsorption of sodium in the proximal tubule, at least here, is going to be tied to hydrogen secretion or.
But I just want to say again, I know we've moved on to maintenance and I'm good with that, but I just want to say again that it's so important that there was generation, because in the same way that we think about, like, when you have ADH on and you reabsorb water, you don't make new water. That's the water that you had in you. And, when you filter glucose and then reabsorb it all proximally, you don't get hyperglycemic from reabsorbing your glucose. You only have what you started with. So similarly, when you're reabsorbing more bicarbonate proximally, it has to be the bicarb you have already. So that's only maintenance, not generation.
Yeah.
That is well put.
Yeah, certainly you know, you think about patients with acute kidney injury or chronic kidney disease developing metabolic alkalosis in the absence of a diuretic or vomiting, there's got to be exogenous bicarb. That's the only way. So when I got that story, I'm always going to search about that. It's like the classic example is a magnesium in dialysis patients or advanced CKD, right? It just, you just don't get a high MAC unless when you have kidney disease, unless there was an exogenous administration or ingestion of. So I think about it that way. And I said in the absence of the diuretics or vomiting, because in those cases, clearly there's a chloride loss. But in the absence of that, if you have AKR CKD, your bicarb went up, something was ingested.
The only reason I wanted to just be careful with that is there are some items on the maintenance that are common to the generation, right? There's things that can do both. Like, so vomiting causes you to lose bicarb. It's a generation factor, but it also causes volume depletion. So it's a maintenance factor also.
Wait, you mean right? lose chloride. You said lose bicarb.
Excuse me. That's right. Lose chloride and lose hydrogen. It induces metabolic alkalosis, but it is also a factor in maintenance. So you don't have separation. Same thing with hyperaldo.
Well,
right.
So in vomiting, early in vomiting, like you're not instantly volume depleted, right? So early in vomiting, and this is getting ahead because he's got a beautiful figure on this later. But early in vomiting, you're vomiting, you lose HCl, right? And you have bicarbonate in excess in the blood. And if you're not volume depleted yet, you're going to dump that extra bicarbonate, as we said. But that bicarb doesn't go out alone. It goes out with a sodium or a K, right? And so that bicarbonaturia can contribute to volume depletion as well.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, Joel, I wasn't really trying to sort of dissociate the mechanisms of maintenance or generation. I agree they could be related and apply to both parts of the metabolic alkalosis. What I was trying to emphasize is that, you know, we sometimes are the diagnosticians of medicine. It comes to a weird alkalosis. And Anders, so patient's got CKD. Oh, it's got CKD. That's why the labs are out of whack. Or why is it marking about? Well, the patient is volume depleted. No, that could keep the alkalosis from getting better. But understanding the generation takes something else helps identify the disorder.
Nice. Okay. Excellent. Excellent. And then the top of 555 is also interesting. He says, so we talked about this increased resorptive capacity in the face of volume depletion. And then he says, yeah, we don't really know how it works. He says that the micropuncture studies say increases in proximal tubule reabsorption cannot quantitatively explain the reduction in bicarbonate excretion.
When I do these edits, I listened to the podcast 5 or 6 times, yet I still missed this. When Burton Rose says the mechanism is not completely worked out, but it seems to be due to increased hydrogen secretion in the distal nephron, what he's talking about is a yet undiscovered hindrance. Rose had the whole puzzle laid out, but it was missing the final piece. He could describe the shape and features of this last piece, but he didn't know its identity. We now know that the final piece is Pendrin, which we talk about a little bit later in the podcast. But I think it is useful context to understand that gaps in Rose's knowledge have subsequently been filled, and that in this part of the chapter, he all but predicts the existence of Pendrin, like an astronomer seeing the wobbles of a nearby planet and predicting the existence of an unseen moon. Can't believe we missed this live while we were recording, and I am embarrassed that I missed it during my edits. Sorry.
And then he gives a likely, though sounds like not for sure, scenario going forward, saying that increased angiotensin II and increased tubular bicarb both contribute to increased bicarbonate reabsorption in the proximal tubule, that angiotensin II increases the sodium hydrogen exchanger activity, and that the increased tubular bicarb also enhances that by allowing more hydrogen secretion before that tubular fluid pH falls too much, right? So you can kind of absorb more of that hydrogen secretion, allowing more bicarb and sodium reabsorption there. And then he says, kind of counterbalancing it, going the other direction, is that metabolic alkalosis directly inhibits that sodium hydrogen exchanger. And this would be an appropriate factor if you want to correct your metabolic alkalosis. You'd want to slow down hydrogen secretion in the proximal tubule. And he says the net effect is that the decrease in bicarb excretion and metabolic alkalosis associated with volume deficiency is primarily due to enhanced net bicarb reabsorption in the distal nephron. And that was like news to me. Like, I thought this was all kind of going to be a proximal tubule story.
Totally news to me, and I still don't understand it.
But the rest of the chapter really drives that home, and all the mechanisms really lay into that distal nephron. And I was like, oh, I thought it was, but that was a kind of like a news flash for me. I like that.
I like it. I mean, if it's truth, it's truth. But one of the things I've always liked about his book is that he kind of stresses you get the basics, and then he doesn't overdo the exceptions to the rule. To me, he's overdoing the exceptions to the rule. I just kind of like, I still like the idea that it's all proximal, and maybe there's a little distal. So this bothers me, and it's my limitation.
Some serious self-examination going on there, Roger. I'm proud of you.
And then leading into what's going on in this distal nephron, he says that secondary hyperaldo contributes to this, that aldo directly is going to stimulate your hydrogen ATPase. It also is going to increase sodium reabsorption distally, which increases that negative tubule charge. And he says, it's funny, I always thought of that negative charge kind of pulling hydrogen out, but he actually says that it prevents hydrogen from back diffusing into the once you've secreted hydrogen. The thing to remember that is so different between the distal nephron and the proximal. In the proximal, because of the presence of carbonic anhydrase, the pH doesn't change. And we had that table or that figure from last chapter or chapter 12 where we talked about the changes in pH as you go through the tubule, and there's almost no change in the proximal tubule. But in the distal nephron, we drive that pH way down, get down to pH of 5, get down to pH of 4.5, right? And that's 1,000 times the concentration of hydrogen in the rest of the body. And with that big concentration gradient, you're going to get back diffusion of hydrogen across there. And having a net negative tubule charge is going to be help hold on to those hydrogen ions.
I wanted to chime in about an aldosterone diversion for a second, if I can. In that part that you'd read, aldosterone directly stimulates the H+ ATPase pump. I just was curious what that meant. And it turns out aldosterone has like this whole secret life that I did not realize. I've always thought of aldosterone being a hormone that crosses the membrine, binds to the mineralocorticoid receptor, leads to upregulation of transcription stuff. This response happens in like 15 minutes. So it is way too fast for any of that stuff to happen.
So the response on the hydrogen secretion is very rapid.
Very fast once you have high aldo levels. And so it actually binds to GPCRs at the cell surface and leads to a signaling cascade that leads to more insertion or activation of the H+ ATPase at the membrane. So aldosterone is not just working, crossing the membrane, transcribing stuff. It's also binding to surface receptors. And this was like mind-blowing for me. And there's like 30 years of literature here that I feel like we just never talk about.
Never talk about that.
I know.
That is interesting. And what do all of our aldosterone antagonists also block these cell surface receptors? Or
I think some of them do and some of them don't. And then the thought is that some of these, like, I know we're a very kidney focused group, but some of these like cardiac remodeling bad side effects of aldo could be mediated by these GPCR pathways and stuff too.
Rather than the classic mineralocorticoid receptor. Interesting. Okay. And then when we're talking about this negative charge, so this is a negative charge in the tubule. The chloride depletion and hypokalemia play a role here, that normally chloride is reabsorbed, depleting the negative charge in the lumen. But without the chloride, this negative charge persists, increasing hydrogen secretion and preventing back diffusion. And kind of similarly, hypokalemia plays the same role, that potassium secretion normally competes with hydrogen secretion. And if you don't have any potassium to secrete, that just opens the lane up for more hydrogen secretion, which is what is going to cause your persistence of metabolic alkalosis.
And perhaps the hypokalemia revs up ammoniogenesis, right, to also favor the excretion of hydrogen.
But there's also direct stimulation of the hydrogen-potassium ATPase pump by hypokalemia, which is going to lead to more acid secretion, which is
right. a little different. This is a weird...
Yeah, a little different than the just competition.
Yeah, and that's the weird one, is that I am so focused on the distal nephron secreting potassium, it kind of blows my mind that there's actually a pathway for reabsorption of potassium distally. I was like, really? Yes, there is. And it is a hydrogen-potassium exchanger. You reabsorb potassium and secrete additional hydrogen so that hypokalemia would stimulate that one appropriately. And then I love the little proof here. He says, you can see this for yourself, that you'll have these patients with metabolic alkalosis. Take a look at their urine pH. Everything should be screaming. It should have alkalotic urine. And sure enough, they'll have this acid pH of their urine. And I just was like, oh yeah, that's what's going on here. This is, you know, it's clearly indicative of a kidney that is not correcting its metabolic alkalosis, the very definition of maintenance.
Yeah, absolutely. But they call it paradoxical. And I just don't like that term because it makes it sound like it's unusual or unexpected. But that's if it wasn't acid, if it were alkaline, you wouldn't have maintenance.
You're correct. That's right. Exactly right.
Which it's is the exactly proof. What you said.
It's the proof of maintenance.
I just don't like the term paradoxical. It bothers me.
I always say that to my students. I say it's called paradoxical aciduria, but it's not a paradox to you. And hopefully they believe me.
Okay. So that is kind of the box on effective circulating volume depletion. And then he moves on to chloride depletion. And he starts saying, you know, we used to call this volume depletion, but we have a bunch of experimental evidence that shows that it's not volume depletion, it's actually chloride depletion. And he kind of goes through this, is that you can fix their volume depletion with albumin, and that will restore tissue perfusion, restore their volume, but it will not correct the alkalosis or stop distal hydrogen secretion if they maintain their chloride depletion. And then you can reverse that experiment, and you can give them chloride without sodium. And I forget the molecules that they actually give. Does anybody have that on the tip of their tongue?
I do. I have it. So these are amazing experiments by Gala and Luke, who have also written some nice reviews over the years in JASN and elsewhere. And so they studied, I think, 6 men. And these men were given...
Were they self-catheterized?
No, this paper is from 1988, so they had moved on from that, and they developed what they called chloride depletion metabolic alkalosis by giving themselves furosemide, and then they protocol 1, they give themselves KCL, and protocol 2, they give sodium phosphate. And they found that with the KCL, they were able to correct the alkalosis, even if they were still volume depleted or sodium depleted. And with the sodium phosphate, they could not.
With the sodium phosphate. So they maintained the chloride depletion, restored their sodium balance. Okay. Yeah.
So what bothers me about this is that the concept that you're chloride depleted, volume depleted, but especially chloride depleted. You give them chloride, but no sodium, and it will fix them. I remember that with the whole albumin story. It was like a huge epiphany to me 20 years ago or something, because I thought it was all volume. I didn't realize the impact of chloride. But here you give something without sodium. So you give something without sodium, and something's maintaining this, and suddenly you're able to excrete bicarb, but you can't excrete bicarb without sodium. So you're going to make your volume depletion worse. It just doesn't seem to make sense to me that the kidney would allow you to do that, allow you to lose more sodium, become more volume depleted to fix your metabolic alkalosis. That just does not fit. The kidney always picks volume over everything else.
And so your argument is you can't believe that someone is volume depleted and that you restore them or give them additional chloride, but not sodium, that they would be able to clear that excess bicarb, because they would have to get rid of that bicarb with sodium. That's your concern.
Boy, absolutely. You nailed it. That.
And is it possible that the cation that they are giving with the chloride, what was the cation? Potassium. They could be excreting potassium bicarbonate. Could that correct their metabolic alkalosis?
Well, maybe that's the answer.
Maybe it's just a different cation.
Okay. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Let's move on.
I'm at your service here. Thanks, okay.
Well, but if you are giving them potassium chloride, then they don't get K depleted because you gave them potassium.
That's right.
But they can get rid of the bicarbonate.
Yeah, that's what Joel was saying. Yeah, that maybe that's the answer. I mean, there's two that says if you give potassium chloride or choline chloride, whatever the hell that is. I don't know what choline chloride is, but either of those will correct it. So maybe you're right. Maybe that's enough chloride and it's not a sodium issue. I just assumed if you excrete chloride, you got to pull sodium with it and that would make things worse. But let's move on.
And we know this clinically, right? I mean, we use potassium chloride all the time to correct an alkalosis. And somebody, let's say, who has edematous state, we've created the alkalosis with a luprothiazide or both. And then we capitalize on the K deficit to try and correct the metabolic alkalosis without giving back sodium chloride.
Yeah, but potassium also, it's more than just that. It also has the whole shift thing, and there's other things going on when you give potassium. So I think it's a little.
So he has three mechanisms by which chloride depletion could perpetuate or maintain metabolic alkalosis. And so first one is the activity of the sodium potassium 2 chloride carrier. And you know, you think I'm going to say in the thick ascending limb of the loop of Henle, but I'm not. The sodium potassium 2 chloride carrier in the macula densa, is its activity is going to be determined by chloride availability. And so the lack of chloride there is going to stimulate renin, resulting in more aldosterone. And that increased aldosterone is then going to drive our hydrogen secretion like we described earlier. And so this is an example where chloride depletion in the macula densa is going to drive aldosterone release, which I thought was interesting. And I was surprised and tricked when I got there. The second one was aluminum hydrogen ATPase is associated with passive co-secretion of chloride out of the cell, right? So this is the classic intercalated cell has a hydrogen ATPase that's going to secrete hydrogen. We don't ever think about, well, where does it, is there something that neutralizes that electrogenic movement of the ion? And actually there is co-secretion of chloride out of the cell. And if you have a low tubular chloride, that will just decrease the friction that hydrogen ATPase has to work against. Again, something that we don't ever talk about. It's kind of a ghost mechanism that, oh, I guess there is something that maintains electroneutrality, and that's it. And then the last mechanism was bicarbonate secretion by a chloride bicarbonate exchanger. Roger, what's that called?
Pendrin.
Roger's bane of his existence. The Pendrin. He was so excited to say that. And this is powered by the inward gradient for chloride. And that the loss of tubular chloride antagonizes this movement of chloride.
So I think the amazing thing about, he talks about chloride, but he doesn't know he knows it's important, but he doesn't know exactly why. And it was a while later that the whole Pendrin thing got figured out.
Pendrin is the name of the apical chloride bicarbonate exchanger in the beta intercalated cell. There is a similar exchanger on the alpha intercalated cell on the basolateral membrane titled anion exchanger 1. Its activity and expression increases in response to low distal chloride delivery and metabolic and intracellular alkalosis. So, in the setting of a metabolic alkalosis, bicarbonate is excreted in the urine. But it may be more apt to think of Pendrin as a chloride reabsorber as its main role, given that its activity and expression increases in low distal chloride delivery. So, the chloride reabsorption is actually coupled with sodium reabsorption from the ENaC channel in the principal cell and sodium-dependent chloride bicarbonate exchanger on the apical membrane of the beta intercalated cell, resulting in net sodium chloride and thus volume reabsorption.
You know, this part of the book, probably the page that I have come back more than any other page in this book, seriously, because the idea that chloride depletion leads to alkalosis has never been intuitive to me. You know, it just doesn't come obvious as water losses, hypernatremia, or hypernatremia, for instance, right? And the third bullet is the one that I grabbed and took with me, because it's the one that is, when you look at that exchanger at the apical membrane and see that once the chloride goes in, bicarbonate goes out, it's like, boom, now I get it. Why chloride and bicarb are so related to each other? Why is it so important? And when you're chloride depleted, you cannot secrete bicarb. And this is the only way you can secrete bicarb in a whole nephron. It's in this exchanger.
I got a question here. When we talk about chloride depletion here, is it kind of a abstract chloride depletion, like when we talk about being sodium depleted, but that's independent of the sodium concentration? Or is this really, can you pick this up on a low chloride concentration in the chemistries? Oh, there's a hypochloremia.
You've got me, don't even get me started on this, because I wanted to bring this up so badly, and I hope I'm right about this, because he keeps talking about hypochloremia, and it's not hypochloremia. Hypochloremia is a sodium water thing. It has to, chloride concentration by itself, in my understanding, is not regulated. It's always reflecting something else. Oh my God, Melanie's giving me two thumbs up. I can sleep tonight. It's not a thing. So, I mean, chloride can be, it's like the same thing about hypochloremic metabolic alkalosis, metabolic acidosis. That's a horrible term, because chloride is related to sodium as well as anion gap. So it's not hypochloremia. It's exactly what you say, Joel. It is total body chloride depletion.
Okay. That's what I envisioned. I just want to make sure that's where we are. Okay.
But he uses hypochloremia several times in this.
Well, and really, to be honest, in metabolic alkalosis, it really usually is, because the sodium level's fixed and you have a very high bicarb. Well, you're running out of anion space and they're going to have decreased chloride, right?
Well, he says early that, you know, one of the things in metabolic alkalosis is hypochloremia. Well, it has to be hypochloremia. Like, otherwise, the only way you can't have hypochloremia is if you have no anion gap, or if you're hypernatremic or something. So I really, really had a problem with that. But so I'm glad you brought it up.
Okay. Melanie, do you have something here?
No, I like that. I'm really glad that you did that, because, you know, chloride goes up and down in parallel to sodium, but it goes up and down opposite to bicarbonate. And so that's why we can't name disorders for the chloride level.
Perfect. And then the last section on the chloride depletion is he kind of walks a little bit away from its chloride, not volume. He says, it really doesn't matter, because they usually walk together. And you see that they walk together because you see how absurd the experiments are to separate them, right? We have to do these crazy things where we give them albumin or we give them potassium phosphate. And I appreciate that. Like, that's true, right? Like, the reason we thought forever it was all volume depletion, it wasn't, and it only recently did we discover it was chloride depletion, is because they look the same. And I think that it's okay for your residents and your medical students to say volume depletion. I don't think you need to spend too much time correcting them and saying it's chloride.
But that's why you can call it volume depleted versus volume, you know, volume responsive or versus not responsive, volume depleted versus not depleted, saline responsive versus not, or chloride. You can say all those things and they're all true, because we usually use normal saline, which is sodium chloride.
And that's what he says. He says saline fixes both of these conditions simultaneously. You give them the chloride and you give them the sodium. And then he again focuses on the importance of distal hydrogen secretion or distal bicarbonate reabsorption in the maintenance of metabolic alkalosis. And he closes this section with that any type of volume depletion will maintain metabolic alkalosis, but only loss of chloride or bicarbonate poor fluid, vomit and diuretics, will generate the metabolic alkalosis. I think we've talked about that a lot. Okay. So in terms of the maintenance, we've gone over volume depletion, we've gone over chloride depletion, and now we are at hypokalemia on page 557.
Can we call it?
I'm fine. Okay, we're done.
Yeah,
perfect. So we're calling it 557.
Yeah.
Perfect. I'm fine with that. Oh my God, it's 11:22.
Melanie's going to go take a sedative.
I know Melanie is ramped up. She can go. She can do the. She's like, we're finishing the book tonight. We're doing the whole damn book.
I'm becoming one with my tabletop, and Melanie's like,
okay. Thank you. But thank you for stopping me.